Welcome back to Arts About.
Show about art that's a work of art in itself, Sally, whether you're bobbing around in the Southern Ocean or not.
Or whether you're a landlubber on land.
Or
sturdy
not.
Legs or not, exactly. Arts About is, of course, brought to you by the generosity of the McClelland Gallery and Sculpture Park and facilitated by the Bendigo Bank Studio. John.
Yeah.
You and Swanee did a pretty good job last week.
Enjoyed ourselves too.
I was chuckling my head off.
We had to get a team of professionals in to clean the studio up after Swan had spent an hour in here.
I'm not surprised. That human cannibal story was just something else. And spontaneous combustion too.
Yeah.
I've experienced that myself.
Same
in a
evening.
Hotel in Amsterdam.
Have you?
Yes.
Good Lord.
Yes, I have. But anyway, we won't go into that. What do you have for us this week, John, that could possibly match last week's story?
Well, I know that you've been in the Southern Ocean and around the bottom of Tassie and doing a bit of crayfishing.
Yeah.
So I thought I might talk about my own experience with crayfish as a child.
Oh, that'd be good. That's thematic.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Okay, that's wonderful. Today we've also got local artist Di Crawford coming into the studio in a few minutes, and she's going to tell us about her exhibition that's on at White Hill Gallery called Rhythms of Nature. I'm looking forward to that. Cliff will be in as well, I suspect.
Excellent.
Yeah. And as you alluded to then, John, I've been having an extraordinary seafaring adventure on the western side of Tasmania on a 90-year-old fishing boat with Will and Tim and Sally Phillips, and I think you know the beautiful boat Storm Bay, don't you, John?
I do, yeah.
We've been exploring down that coast there, cray potting, shark fishing, and seeing some rather remarkable coastline off Tasmania for the last week. And we set off through Hell's Gate at Strawn and turned left and finished up at Malaluka in Port Davey, which, did you know, is the only fjord in the Southern Hemisphere?
Oh.
It's actually a fjord. There's glacial, you can see in all the geography, glacial effects in the rocks.
Is that what defines a fjord?
I'm not sure if that is what defines a fjord, but I think you'll find, maybe glaciers cause fjords.
Right. Well. Yeah.
Maybe what the maybe.
If it's
right.
The only fjord in this, then it must be defined in some way. You know, sort of made by a glacier or a certain height off the water or something.
I think it must be made by a glacier.
Right.
Better look into that because I shouldn't go off spouting those things and not really know, should I?
Hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Might be something that Tim Phillips said.
No, I think it was his cousin, actually, David Wilkins, who told us about that. Yes.
Right, okay.
Yeah, all right. I better check that out. But we turned left out of Hell's Gate in Strawn and found ourselves heading south in very big lumpy seas. And as I held onto the mask, exhilarated, watching albatross wheel about the boat and the odd penguin and seal poking their heads up out of the waves. But all the while, I felt my stomach lifting and dropping. And I have to admit, dear listeners, I finally succumbed to sea sickness, which lasted for a few interminable hours before I gained my sea legs. And to rub it in, Will has found me a lovely little track to play this morning. And although we were in the Southern Ocean, it is nonetheless a glorious tale of chundering by Barry Humphreys and the old Pacific Sea. Our next guest hails from Perth, but these days calls Cape Shank her home. Di Crawford has worked as an artist most of her life, and although earlier manifestations of her work were intricate embroideries, these days she prefers a medium. The medium seems to be acrylic paint. She is presenting an exhibition of her work titled Rhythms of Nature at White Hill Gallery on White Hill Road in Dramana, and the exhibition runs until April the 17th. Good morning, Di. Welcome to Arts About.
Good morning, Sally.
Thanks so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
Di, when I look at your work, I see a really strong love of country.
Absolutely. I think nature has an incredible thing to teach us all, and I think we spend our lifetime ignoring it. And I think being, especially down in the peninsula, I've been able to enjoy it again. I've spent a lot of time in the country in Western Australia and up north and out of Carnarvon and Exmouth Gulf, and I just think Australia is the most beautiful country, and we need time to enjoy it and embrace it.
Absolutely. Clearly you've travelled the country a lot. I've looked on your website and seen a lot of your paintings,
yeah.
And there's some incredible places. There's Dampier Peninsula, Parachilna Gorge, cassowaries, desert landscapes. Have you spent a lot of time travelling around, camping around Australia?
Yes, we just bush camp, and I take a lot of photographs because we move at such a rate because my husband has a desire to see the next thing.
He's not in the moment.
No, not in the moment. But the photographs take me back there and I work from them. We have a son who lives in Darwin who works as a lawyer for the Indigenous people. So it's a great excuse to go up and see him. He takes us out to the communities. And we spent time out there with the Aboriginal people and seeing them work. And I think Aboriginal art is such a... Oh, they've just captured Australia.
Yes.
They have absolutely captured it. And I think words, you know, are unnecessary because you just look at the paintings, it's telling a wonderful story.
There's a little bit of what happens in Indigenous art in the decorating of the spaces within animals and wildlife that migrates into your work, in the patterning in some of the fish and some
exactly.
of the birds.
Yes.
And so obviously you've been paying attention there. The other thing I liked about what I was looking at was a lot of people who start using acrylic paint, because acrylic paint's open generally in a jar, and they don't cost a great deal. They're expensive, the good ones, but they don't cost a fortune. And you can see all that paint there, and they're easy to clean up. A lot of people just go ahead and use them without a lot of mixing or a lot of thought going on. And I noticed that you're one of the people who's managed to manifest a really disciplined palette. And I think you should be congratulated on that, actually, because it's a very rare thing with acrylic paint that the palette is so concentrated.
Yes, well, I started working in oils. I actually find it's a wonderful medium to work in, but I'm terrible migraine sufferer.
Yeah, the headaches
just,
are terrible.
It's just not viable for me to paint in oils. So, but you can do a lot with acrylics. They can be very flat and boring.
Well, they can be.
You've got to work with them.
Yeah, work with them, exactly.
While your work is clearly pictorial, there's a lot of spirituality going on in there, and you can see, particularly with the patterning that you mentioned, John, you can see sort of internal landscapes in the things that you're painting. You know, a lot of what the spirit of the animal and the spirit of the country that the animal comes from, some of those portraits are remarkable.
Well, that's what I try to do. I mean, you look at something, it isn't just a subject. It has depth and it has intricate things happening inside. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I see life. You know, I don't just look at something. I look into it and hopefully feel it. And each painting I think, my golly, where am I going to go? Mm-hmm. And it just, I get lost in it, and I hopefully get the message I'm trying to pass from myself. You know, I'm passionate about it.
About the land.
And I think we just take it for granted too much. And if it's a little way of capturing someone's way of enjoying it.
Tell us a little bit about that style, because it's evolved evolved a long way. I didn't know, actually, until I looked through your website, that you originally started working with thread.
Yeah, well, I studied fine art in the mid-60s. Didn't quite finish my course because I got married instead. Mm-hmm. And then I retaught myself, and it started off basically at home when I'd done my chores and the children are in bed and finished their homework. I started in thread. I thought, well, thread is a good way of trying to make it look and feel like a painting with depth. And I couldn't work with patterns that people do with a normal embroidery. You've got to create your own. And then once everyone got older and I had more time, I devoted my time. We bought a place down here in the 99, and I have a studio for the first time then, and I spend as many hours as I possibly can in the studio, as well as, you know, the other things of life that keep us busy.
I'm fascinated that you say you have more time, because to me, when I think about thread work, I can only imagine that would be more time-consuming than anything else.
It's time-consuming, but it's something you can pick up and put down.
Without making a mess.
And I'd sit up till 3 or 4 in the morning working. I didn't need a room for it. and I didn't have a studio at the time, so that's how it started. And it was building up confidence too after many years of not painting. I had to re-teach myself and have the confidence to do what I'm doing, because all I was doing was nappies and children for a long time.
It's quite consuming, isn't it?
A little bit, especially with six of them.
I think you can see the embroidery passed in the... in the paintings, in the painted images. It's also interesting to me that you have that patterning on the, like, particularly on fish and things like that, which has an indigenous sort of feel to it, but it also has a sort of a William Morrissey sort of feel, like maybe
the swirls and the patterning.
And I've never made that connection myself before between indigenous decoration and you know, arts and craft kind of decoration out of Europe in the, but it's there and it's made quite clear in some of your images. I found it very interesting, actually.
Yes, well, I think you've got to keep evolving, and where my next movements go, I have no idea.
Right. But we will get there. True artist.
You never feel satisfied with your own work, and you're always trying to improve, and that's what we hope to do in life. And if it's in the arts or with our own personal lives, it's a journey, and it's an interesting journey. And I just see patterns in things. I see intricate. Involve things in within things, and I think that's where I'm sort of a little stuck at the moment. I'm in it, and I
do you enjoy the other side of it as well? There's because there's the in the studio bit, which is very generally very private and very thoughtful, and then there's the exhibiting side and a crowd of adoring fans and all that sort of stuff.
Yes, I'd prefer the studio personally. But
you do, however, have an exhibition coming up.
Yes, but I think if you don't put yourself in a slightly uncomfortable position, you don't grow. Right. And I think there's no point in just painting and locking the studio, because in life I think it's about sharing. I think if people write a book, there's no point in leaving it on a shelf and never being published. If there's no point in singing a song, and if you're capable of singing to an audience and giving pleasure and joy, and the same with artwork. I mean, but my most comfortable spot is in the studio by myself with the dogs, actually.
Now, the exhibition at White Hill Gallery, we don't know really anything about White Hill Gallery. Tell us a little bit about
I was approached by Rhea Ori, which is Ted and Helen Ori. They started up the little restaurant gallery at White Hill.
After they moved from La Campagna.
Absolutely.
In Cape Town.
He was going to retire, but then got itchy feet again and decided to start up again. And their daughter studied an art degree, and she is going to organise and manage the gallery side of it. And this is their first opening they had the other night, and they did a wonderful job. There were lots of yummy food, and some local people arrived, which was lovely. I haven't had an exhibition on the Mornington Peninsula before. I've always had them in the city, and they're quite different sort of, you know, and they're 1 week opening gallery, you know, exhibitions, but this is running for a while, so hopefully people will enjoy to go along and meet.
Yeah, they've got more of a chance to see your work.
Yes, and it's a lovely little restaurant, and it's quiet, and it's the work looks. I was quite surprised. It looks very nice up there.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to perhaps.
And hopefully people go and enjoy the peninsula and a nice coffee and some lunch, and can enjoy my work.
And your beautiful paintings, yes, of course. Now, your gallery, your exhibition, Rhythms of Nature, runs until April the 17th, I think.
That's right.
And that's at White Hill Gallery, which is on the... the
Dramana Road.
The Dramana Road. Mm. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us today, Di Crawford. It's been a great pleasure, and we hope the exhibition goes really well.
Well, thank you very much, and I hope people enjoy seeing it.
Thanks. See you soon.
Thanks, Di.
Now, I thought I'd just play you a tiny little episode, a tiny little piece, chapter really, from the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. I'm not sure if it's really bad luck, but of course this is the longest major poem written by English poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge in about 1780. We don't have time for the full version, so here's a taste of Richard Burton's wonderful version, and it's a chapter called Albatross.
And now it's time for John Orr.
Thank you, Swanee. Now, interesting that, Sally, a little bit of Coleridge, allegedly.
Yeah, it was allegedly, actually. There really wasn't very much of it in there, was it?
There was more tubular bells going on than there was any.
It was a little bit. It was an odd choice. I accept that, John. Yeah. So sorry, listeners, if you didn't
voice
like that.
That voice is still beautiful, though.
He has a beautiful voice.
Yeah. I don't want to break John Orr up into little sections or anything. Yeah. And I'm going to talk about my experience with crayfish as a child.
Oh, yes, you
but
that.
I just thought I might mention a little bit of swing tag news before I do that.
Oh, okay, yes. This is a preamble to John Orr.
I couldn't help noticing in the New York Times during the week that they reported that someone's bought two paintings as a pair, a de Kooning and a Pollock, $500 million for the two.
And why are they a pair?
Well, they were just sold at the same time.
Right. Yes,
but this
okay.
is outside the auction houses. The auction houses will be furious.
Right.
How dare people just deal with each other?
With that much
what
money.
What a bargain I get out of that.
Yeah, that's right. They'll be spewing, actually, won't they?
Spewing.
Because imagine what the commission would be on $500 million. Well,
there'd be some arrangement. It'd be a lot of money.
It'd be a lot.
It's a lot of money sloshing around.
Yeah. And what do you think of the paintings?
Oh, I think the de Kooning is an absolutely $300 million painting. That's what he paid for it. Belonged to Mr. Geffen. David Geffen, and it's gone off to someone else. And the Pollock, I don't know much about, but it's only a small Pollock painting, and you would think it makes blue poles just out of reach. There's not enough money on the planet to buy blue poles these days.
No, wonder what that does make blue poles.
I don't think you can put a price on it. It's not for sale anyway.
No.
When I was a kid, we used to go and spend our summers in a beautiful house called Summerland House.
What a great name for a summer house.
Yeah. And it was on the bluff of Summerland Beach on Phillip Island.
Oh, it sounds like something out of Disneyland.
And was essentially right in the middle of the penguin parade. And so as kids, we'd go and stay at the penguin parade all summer.
Is that a dream come true?
And there was a little wooden staircase from the house down into the Penguin Parade and that part of the beach, and there was a kind of a milk bar down there. And
the Penguin Parade where everybody goes and sits now, it's right there.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
The house isn't there anymore, but it was on top of the bluff there.
Wow.
And it was a big old rambling sort of beach house with undulating lino floors. And none of the doors fit in the frames, you know, lots of squeaking
doors.
Because
the sand hills sort of shift underneath the house,
It had penguins living under the house.
Wow.
So they'd make that sort of penguin noise all night. And I can't do it. No, it's more of a...
Oh, that one, yes.
Yeah. And they'd make that noise all night. We were regularly attacked by penguins as children. We had bites all over our ankles from penguin beaks.
How lovely.
But we used to go and muck around with the crowd. As kids, if people arrive in by the busload and you know they're going to go away by the busload, there's almost a responsibility as kids to go down there and try and get something out of them.
Or trip them up.
Do something.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And we used to do a lot of things and enjoy it immensely. But part of one summer I remember particularly was we got up early in the morning, and my father and my uncle said that we were off to do something in particular, and we walked off down the beach. The beach is maybe 1.5 kilometres long. We wandered around to the other end of the beach where my father and my uncle donned some football jumpers. And they wandered off into the water around some low reefs out at, in the surf, and they were bending over under the water and mucking around out there. And then in not too long, it didn't take them very long, and they started wandering in with crayfish that they were just hanging on to. So they were, these things were just sitting in under the reef at the end of the beach, and they could
bend reach up, in and get them.
They could reach in and grab them.
What did the football jumpers have to do with it?
Keeping them a bit. Well, it was a bit of a chilly morning. I think they wanted to keep the wind off them or something.
Right.
Both Melbourne jumpers, I have to point out.
Right.
And both, oddly, with the number 31 on the back.
Really?
Yeah.
I wonder who played for Melbourne, 31. Who was 31?
That'd be Ron Barassi.
Oh, would it? Okay, yeah. That's me from not knowing anything about football would ask that question.
The only Melbourne football jumper I ever saw at the time had 31.
Oh, did they? Yeah, okay.
Anyway, they grabbed those crayfish. We had Hessian bags with us, and I remember my father put a couple of crayfish into a Hessian bag and told me that I could carry it back to the house. And I can still remember the feeling of that salt water dripping down my back and the crayfish moving around in the bag as I was walking back down the beach. And a really special feeling, actually. It felt great. I knew we were going to eat them.
Yeah, hunter-gatherer. It's primal, isn't it?
I had a growing sympathy for the crayfish. I was perhaps daydreaming about escaping them, you know, helping them to get away from what was going to happen to them, which I didn't do in the end. We ate them in the end, but got them back to the house, and the sawn-off 44-gallon drum got rolled out from round the back, and a little fire lit under it, full of salt water and a little bit of seaweed, I remember.
Oh, a little bit of flavouring, lovely.
Yeah, and in they went to the boiling water, and I think they were eaten a couple of days later or something. I think there was some theory that you'd cook them and then wait a day or two before you ate them.
Oh, no, we don't subscribe to that theory anymore. And in fact, these days we drown them first in fresh water so that it's a less traumatic entry into the boiling water.
Well,
and they don't drop their legs either.
No concern for the crayfish on this particular occasion. But I do remember being told that day later when they were being eaten, as my father ripped them to bits, and he said to me, you know, a grown man can eat a crayfish tail, but a young boy, I'm not sure should dare. You can probably handle the legs or the claws.
Them's fighting words.
But the tail would be a little rich for a young stomach, you know. And it took me till I was 20 till I dared eat the tail of a crayfish.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm. Well, I do know that the you know, the red that sits on the skin of the crayfish, when you pull the tail out and there's all that redness on the outside, which is essentially the beginnings of the new skin, the new exoskeleton, that a lot of that will give you some pretty serious nightmares.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there's definitely something in it that's a little bit toxic and perhaps...
Particularly as a child?
Perhaps? No, I think that's rubbish. I think that they're just saving the best for themselves.
I worked that out.
Fantastic. What a beautiful story.
Well, we had a lot of fun later on in the evening just holding little bits of crayfish out under the house and tempting penguins out to nibble on them.
Really? Mm. Cooked crayfish?
Yeah.
How divine. Fantastic. I've got a lovely little track here for you coming up, John.
Yeah, what's that?
Yeah, it's called the Bossa Nova Watusi Twist. It's Freddie King. I think it's from about the 1940s. It's divine. I love it.
Not the Tubular Bells version?
No, go Brody. Well, I'm almost sad to hear that go. That was very, very groovy stuff, don't you think?
That was rocking.
It certainly was. I've been dancing around to that all morning. But now is the most important moment of the show, of course. Our elder, our revered agitator, writer, blogger, and soothsayer, Cliff Ellen, has taken his seat at the microphone. Good morning, Cliff.
Good morning, Sally. Good morning, John.
Cliff.
Yes, that was a lovely song. Yes. Beautiful. I'm not going to talk about the Academy Awards.
Good.
Because I'm sick to death of the Golden Globes and the British Awards.
No.
I will say that Naomi Watts looked wonderful in a purple dress or purple and white or something. That's a bit of a fascination, John. You can tell me on this one.
Purple and white?
No, little Naomi Watts is a slip of a girl.
Yeah.
What you might call quite pretty, right?
Mm.
So why does she look so sexy? I can't work that out.
Oh.
Some people look really sexy.
Yeah.
And some people who are supposedly traditionally better looking don't look sexy.
Yes.
Or is it just in the eye of the beholder?
Well, I think it's also a little bit of a... they've got a little bit of a fire in them, Cliff.
You think so? Yeah. It must be in their eyes.
Yeah.
I don't know. Every time I look at her, I think, yeah, she's a very sexy girl. Of course, I'm too old for the sexy girls. But I'm still allowed to sort of appreciate
them. You know? I would, yeah, of course.
So what have we got this week? Well, we've got the Adelaide Festival.
Mm-hmm.
It's in its fourth and final year under the artistic director of David Sefton. Adelaide at Labor, aren't they? He's going to be replaced next year by Rachel Healy and Neil Armfield. But as far as I know, the Adelaide Festival of the Arts have chopped off about $1 million from their budget. That gets me a bit. I mean, if they're a Labor government, I expect them to, you know, show
spend
a little
money
bit towards culture. But all it proves is they're no different. Both parties are the same. They don't, really don't take art or culture on board. They sort of play lip service. That's the way I think anyway, you know. And then they say, you know, the government remains committed to supporting our important film festivals and cabarets and so on, cultural activities, etc. What a load of rubbish.
Yeah.
God, well, politicians aren't in that world, really, are they? They're sort of in a completely different world. And I think they see it as something that they know they have to spend some money on, but their intention isn't to find quality. Their intention is to spend as little as possible.
Yeah, that's true. But, I mean, look, we did have Gorton and we did have Keating, and they both put a lot into culture. And everybody appreciated it.
And as we mentioned earlier, we do as a nation own Blue Poles as a result of Gough Whitlam buying it, $1.2 million.
Mm-hmm. Heavily criticised, yeah, that's true.
Lord knows what that might be worth if it had a swing tag on it.
Yeah, but I think what it really does is it describes the overarching view that is the diminishing importance that anybody, the politicians, are putting on the value of arts, which is, you know, which is basically as a language.
Yeah.
It's an important language that we have, but it's not really being appreciated. The economic dollar and fiscal management seems to be king and becoming more so. I hope it's a pendulum shift. I hope we come back one day to actually realise how important for the sake of the human race it is to be able to communicate and empathise and explain ourselves. And there's a phone crime going on and I have committed it. Yeah. I do beg your pardon.
Just summarising, on a really simplistic level, it adds to the quality of our lifestyle.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, is the bottom line. And, you know, we don't have to go into detail, but...
Yeah, I think it does more than that too. I think the dialogue, you know, arts dialogue plays a huge role in how we relate to each other as human beings, which then creates, you know, an atmosphere in the world, whether it's to do with, you know, our attitudes to people who are different to us, whether it's to do with war, whether it's to do with money, all of those things. I actually think that art creates the way for us to communicate about these things as human beings. That's what I think.
I agree with
that. It's another language.
It is another language, yeah.
Moving on to another matter.
Oh, dear, okay, I overstepped the mark there. Sorry.
No, you haven't. That's good. I like that. I'm, you know, I'm getting old. I find it hard to, you know, shoot out these ideas off the top of my head like I once could because I keep forgetting things quite often. In fact, that's why I often say to you, I don't take questions without notice because my memory bank sort of goes a bit.
Yeah.
You know, I'll think of it outside, but in the studio, no. Actor Samuel Johnson, on his Facebook page, when announcing he was quitting acting to focus on raising money for breast cancer research. Johnson was a star of the recent highly rated Channel 7 Molly, which was a Melbourne biopic sort of thing. I won't play pretend on television while science is being murdered, he said. Not while federal funding for research remains static for 10 years, not while the CSIRO is being bulldozed, not while climate science is still being denied, not until I fulfil my promise to you. I do apologise to Samuel. I rubbished the show, Molly. I know it was a top-rated show. But look, good on him. No, good luck.
I've watched it. Oh, I've watched one of the episodes of it yet. I've still got to see the other half. And I actually really did like it. And I'm not sure. I like Samuel Johnson in it. But I also think that it was so great to see some of that story of Molly. You know, we've forgotten, actually, what an incredible character he was and how grateful probably we should all be to him for, you know, getting that stuff
I think, as I said before, you know, I prefer the doco with Julia Zemira doing it. I thought you saw much more on that than
yeah,
the
that.
Were you there at the time, Sally, producing the show or something? Did you produce Countdown or something?
No, but I wish that I was. I do remember so vividly being a profoundly affected by it and watching it and right. you know, hanging out.
Oh, it was very important.
Yeah, it was really, really important.
Big part of the week.
Yep.
Mm. All right. Well, are we running out of time?
We can give him...
I mentioned a couple of things. Gods of Egypt... with a production budget of $140 million. The film was shot in Sydney at Fox Studios. It got a one-star review. And it had Robin Nevin, Bruce Spence, Jeffrey Rush and Brian Brown in it, involving a story about a mere mortal, Breck, who is embarking on a mission to save his busty girlfriend from the horrors of afterlife. I tell you what, they get away with money in Sydney, don't they?
Oh.
They're good at that. I saw a film on World Movies last night, which was a 2015 film. It was about the making of E, whoever E was. It was a female. I watched about half an hour. It was really bad. But how do they get them up? I don't
understand. I don't know either. It costs a lot of money to make a feature film these days. Like $100 million isn't unusual, is it?
$140 million,
so.
No. But I think the one I saw on World Movies last night, how do you get a film on World Movies before it's been anywhere else? That's what gets me.
Right.
But that wouldn't have been $140 million. That would have been about $6
million. Yeah. And big price tags. But they make big money if they can get the audience, I guess.
That's the thing, yeah. They can make huge amounts of money.
Hmm.
Picnic and Hanging Rock. Mm. March the 20th, Malthouse Theatre. Artistic director Matt Luton brings the works to the stage. We are currently experiencing a renaissance in stage adaptation of classic Australian literature, and he sees this as not only favourable but necessary. We make our literature a canon in the retelling of it. It's a retelling that defines it more than the original telling. Picnic is the beginning of a series of retellings I want to do over the next few years. We know we're up there as a country by the way we retell our national myths. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm.
Well done, Matthew.
He's the new artistic director there, isn't he?
He is.
Yeah,
but I'm a very sarcastic person.
You are. That's
somehow
true.
You've got to get some idea of what I'm really saying.
Yeah, we do. We see the undercurrent, the subtext.
That's all. You could watch Cuffs on the ABC.
What's that?
I think it's on, I'm not sure what night it's on, but it's a new police drama. It's quite good.
Cuffs?
Yeah, but The Bridge is still the best show on television.
Yeah, well.
By a mile. Anyone who doesn't like The Bridge, well, obviously they're a different world to me. Do you like The Bridge, John?
I haven't been watching The Bridge. I've been limiting myself pretty well to Jack Irish and...
they're both on the same night.
I haven't started that yet. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, they're both on the same night. But it really is. Thursday's a big night. The rest of the week is rubbish. Yeah.
Mm.
You know. So
there's I think that for myself, television is becoming a great vehicle for documentary watching.
Oh, there's some beauties there.
Yeah.
There's some good ones on the doco. So I revert to that when I'm in a desperate state where I go to the computer and whip onto the porn site or something. Did I say that?
Say that, Cliff.
Joking.
I think he was making a joke, folks.
Yes.
Hey, what are you going to do for the rest of the afternoon?
I'm going home to finish my column because it's due in tonight.
Oh, is it? Yeah, okay. And what about a song this week?
Elvis Presley.
Woohoo!
Anything. By Elvis.
Well, what about blue suede shoes?
That will do, yes. I wore them once.
Did you?
Yes, I did in those days.
Fantastic.
Brogues, blue suede brogues.
Oh, lovely. We were doing a bit of twisting just before, actually.
Yes.
The bossa nova watusi twist.
Yeah, no, I was a jive person.
Okay. I suppose that's what this
came
is, isn't
later.
It?
Bye all. Bye, ladies.
See you later, John. Lovely to see you.
And you.
It's time for the news.
Indeed.
John?
Yeah, there goes that typewriter. Very fast typing.
I know. Can you type that fast?
No, Will can, apparently.
Yeah, he does. Now, Land of the Golden Fleece, a collection of Arthur Streeton paintings, yep, is on at the Geelong Gallery.
Swanee and I were sort of making a plan to go over there to Geelong and nick up to Bendigo as well.
I heard that, the road trip. Yep. Yeah, can I come?
Sure.
Oh, good. Great. Okay. Yeah. That exhibition is on in Geelong until June 13th, so there's plenty of time, but don't let it run out. Now, in a world first...
Written in small type, in a world first. Shouldn't that be in large type?
It should be in large type. Yes, yeah, it was. It should be. This is an example of my appalling typing habits.
Oh, okay.
In a world first, Melbourne Fringe is excited to announce Open Book, a new program in partnership with Melbourne UNESCO City and Literature Office. Now, they're asking for expressions of interest. What they're interested in is, in fact, it's something a little bit like Cliff was saying. They are interested in arts projects that express something to do with literature, whether it's a retelling or whether it's a piece of art that brings a piece of literature to life. I don't know. Anyway, that's open now. You should go on the website if that's of any interest to you. The Melbourne Fringe Festival in 2016 is much later on in the year, but applications for artist participation are opening on the 4th of April. So if you've got some ideas brewing in your head that even aren't literary ideas but that might fit into Fringe, have a think about it and go and look on their website.
It's an exhibition of Jan Senberg's drawings, Niagara Gallery.
Yeah, that would be
Mr. Senberg's is my drawing teacher at RMIT.
Was he now?
Yep.
Oh, I was looking at his work over the... I saw that that exhibition was on and I was just going back through the history. My goodness, it's amazing, isn't it?
He used to make us draw bits of screwed up paper.
Did he? Are you
any
good at it?
We didn't want to do that. We had to go and talk to him about it in the pub over the road.
Fantastic.
The Biennale in Sydney, that's kicking off in a couple of weeks' time. My own show in Sydney opens the night before.
Does it now?
Yeah.
That could be another road trip. We are going to be busy this year, aren't we?
Yeah. We're going to drive up.
Are you?
Yeah, we might go up the coast.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Now, did you know that the Melbourne International Comedy Festival is coming soon?
No.
Yeah, end of this month, 23rd. Right. 23rd to the 17th of April. So if you want to get onto their, you should get onto their website to see details if you want to go and enjoy a
very successful, the Melbourne Comedy Festival.
It certainly is. It's
very well known around the world. Everyone loves going along. How do you go with comedy? Do you...
I quite like it. I these days I find sort of, you know, traipsing up there and being part of the comedy festivals probably not exactly my thing, but I do have a few favourites, I must admit.
I used to love going to a bar, having a few beers and listening to someone swear, but I'm kind of sick of that now.
A little bit over that now. Yeah. I mean, there's a great variation. Don't get us wrong, folks.
I do like sophisticated comedy.
Sophisticated comedy is good, yes. Now, don't forget Di Crawford's exhibition, Rhythms of Nature, is on at the White Hill Gallery. Now, that's on the, I think it's the Bittendramana Road. It's a new gallery. You can even go there and have some lunch, I think.
Yeah, and new owners at the Summers General Store.
Yes.
So we might talk to him.
Yeah, there is. There's something going on at the Store Cafe, it's called, Summers General Store. New owner wants to reinvigorate the artistic talent.
We'll drag him in here.
Yeah, I think his name's Malcolm.
Yeah.
Now, if you've just tuned in, you've missed Arts About, I'm afraid, but you can catch up with the show via podcast, which should make its way to the station website sometime tomorrow. That's Monday. Or you can listen to a rebroadcast of it on Wednesday at 12.
Or podcast.
Yeah. There's lots of ways of listening to us. Have a look on the Facebook page. I'll try and put a few links up. You might want to have a look at Di Crawford's work, which I'll get some pictures of up there. And have a look on our Facebook page. Yeah. Like us. We need some more likes. I'm getting a bit sick of the old likes.
Fringe Festival book thing.
Yes.
They might be interested in my brother Andrew's book. You know, he made a book.
Yes.
He made the paper and he made the thread that he stitched all the paper together with. He made the ink. And he cut the nibs for the pens that he used to apply the ink to the pages. He made everything that is in the book.
I think he should get in contact with the Fringe Festival then.
So do I.
Yeah, good idea. Remember, everybody, we may not know everything about art.
We do know what we like.
We do know what we like.